Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Edgar Lujano filling in for Cy Kellett today. When you hear that music, you know what's going to happen. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. Truly a pleasure to be here with you. It's been a bit of an interesting week here at Catholic Answers, where it's been a lot of pre-records and haven't taken a lot of questions. Well, today we're going to keep that trend going just for this week, and next week we'll be back to take all of your questions all week long. So, like I said, two full hours of Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Although today is not a pre-record, we're here live.
That's true. It is not, in fact, a pre-record. So that's one positive thing. So we can actually interact with people a little bit more on the chat. Although we don't actually do that too often for the show, which is all right. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, Jimmy, before we jump into actual questions, if somebody wants to submit a weird question to you, how would one go about doing so?
Well, it happens in different ways. One of the ways it happens is I occasionally post a community note on my YouTube page saying, hey, I've got a Weird Questions show coming up, or a recording for Weird Questions coming up. Does anyone have any weird questions? And lots of people post responses to that. And that's how I get most of the questions, but it's not the only way. Sometimes people will email. They may email me, in which case I take their question and I put it in a log for use on the next or future Weird Question shows. They also sometimes email like radio@catholic.com, and you guys forward it to me, and then I put it in the log of questions for future Weird Question shows. And I try to prioritize the ones that are emailed. So if you email me, I try to get it in the very next show that we do.
Yeah, I know on occasion we also tend to get some weird questions whenever we're doing a live show for an Ask Me Anything. But I kind of like the idea of just having them all together, because then you can always go back and have some fun and just listen to a full hour or 2 hours of just weird mm-hmm. questions. So,
well, we'll do that anyway. I don't mind having occasional weird questions on an Ask Me Anything. I think it spices things up a little more, rather than just having another iteration of did Jesus have brothers, or where is purgatory in the Bible, or something like that.
It's like you've heard a few of those here and there, haven't you? Those questions.
I have heard some of them. I've thought about writing a series of books that answer the most common questions. The first volume in the series would be called something like "I Told You Already," and the next might be called something like "Don't Ask Me Again." And the titles would get progressively more irritable as the series goes on.
Fair enough. Well, we'll keep the audience informed if that book ever comes out. So we'll see. But in the meantime, let's jump right into the questions. So let's start off with Mari. Mari asks, can human beings possess one another? For example, would brainwashing techniques done by the CIA or other government agencies with use of LSD and other mind-altering drugs count as possession? My understanding is that the subject's personality is changed, and they become very influenceable. Is this a form of possession by humans?
Okay, so there are several things that Mari brings up here that are interrelated. One of them is use of LSD, and LSD is a substance that the CIA did extensive experiments with in the 1950s and 60s, precisely because they were looking, as part of the Cold War, for a way to control people's minds and behavior. So they got all of this LSD. In fact, the reason LSD became popular in the 60s was because the CIA popularized it without meaning to. They bought all this LSD, and then they started using it in their tests. And some people said, "Wow, that was a fun experience. I wonder if I could do that on my own." They didn't even know many of them they were even being tested on. This was part of a program that was run by the CIA under the direction of a man named Sidney Gottlieb. And the program overall was called MKUltra, and it engaged in extraordinarily unethical behavior. And there were numerous sub-projects within MKUltra looking for ways to mind control people. And just to give one example of not only is it unethical to test drugs on people without their informed consent, but that's unethical right there. But there was a particular gentleman in like 1953, I believe, who actually worked with MKUltra named Frank Olson. And he was dosed at a retreat for CIA employees. A lot of the people who got tested were just members of the public, but he was at a retreat on the East Coast for CIA employees, and they had some Cointreau, which is kind of orange flavored liqueur, at this retreat, and they gave, you know, glasses of Cointreau to everybody. And what they didn't know was that the Cointreau had been dosed with LSD. And after Frank Olson had his, there's a dispute. According to some sources, he did get high from the LSD. According to others, he was one of the rare people that LSD doesn't affect at all. But either way, he had a crisis of conscience because he had been over in Europe and had seen the human experimentation that the CIA was doing on like prisoners from World War II. And he decided he was going to go to the press and spill the beans. And the CIA could not have that. So on the claim, whether it's true or not, that he had gotten high as a result of the LSD, they portrayed him as having a psychotic break, and they took him up to New York City to be treated by a psychiatrist who was affiliated with the CIA, and they took him to a hotel, and his room was like up on the 13th floor of the hotel. And what do you know, but one night he goes out the window and kersplat on the pavement below. And according to some people with knowledge of the situation, he was actually defenestrated. He was thrown out the window to his death to keep him from spilling the beans on what the CIA was doing. Well, the MKUltra, eventually Sidney Gottlieb retired, and the MKUltra program either itself went away or changed names, and so it's not trackable. But in the early 1970s, Frank Olson's son Eric learned about this, that his father had been working with the CIA, and that's why it connected with how his father died. And they admitted, yeah, he did. He had this psychotic break after he was dosed without his knowledge with LSD. And his family was received at the White House by President Gerald Ford, who apologized to him. And Eric has never been satisfied. He continues to promote, how can we find out the truth about what happened with my father? And I actually did an episode of Mysterious World about Frank Olson. But he's just one example. Now, when Sidney Gottlieb retired, the director of the CIA one of the high ups of the CIA had all of the MKUltra files destroyed, so that what MKUltra did could never come out. But a congressional committee in the 1970s, known as the Church Committee, started to look into the matter. And the CIA was like, hey, we don't have any files. They were unfortunately all destroyed to save shelf space or something. And it turned out that they had missed a batch of files that were primarily financial records of different sub-projects within MKUltra. And so those came to light, and those got looked at. Now, reportedly, there are some additional MKUltra files that still exist, and that just in the last couple of days, they were being reviewed for declassification per orders from President Trump. And reportedly, while President Trump is out of the country, in the last couple of days, representatives of the CIA swooped in and confiscated those files. And now there's a kerfuffle in Congress where Representative Luna is saying, you've got 24 hours to bring those files back. So there's some really interesting stuff here. But one of the things about LSD, which Mari mentions, is it doesn't seem to be that great for mind control. They experimented with it, but it doesn't seem to really do that. Whether the CIA has abilities, whether they were able to develop abilities to control someone's mind or their behavior is something that's disputed. According to the CIA and what they said with the Church Committee was, well, we experimented in this area, you know, but it didn't work, and that's why we killed MKUltra. Others have said, no, they did get some methods that would allow them to significantly modify a person's mental processing and behavior. They just kept it underground. And so there's a whole interesting area there that I'm exploring over time on Mysterious World. But let's suppose, per Mari's question, let's suppose that they did develop a way to control someone's mind. Would that be possession? Well, it wouldn't be possession in the way possession is conceived of in the Bible, where you have a spirit that seizes control of a living human. It would instead be a kind of external programming of one person by another living person. So it wouldn't be the same thing. It would be kind of similar in that the affected person is under the influence or control of another living person or of someone else. But in that case, it would be another living person, not a spirit. So that would be the basic distinction. If you want to know, could a human being possess another human being in a more biblical sense? Well, that's an interesting question. One question would be, would it be a living human being controlling another living human being, or would it be a departed human spirit controlling a living human being? If it's the first, it would be some kind of telepathic manipulation where one living person, like if I wanted to control you, we're both living people, I might use a mental message to try to get you to do what I want. And there is at least some claimed evidence for something like that happening. There was a researcher in the Soviet Union during the Cold War doing their version of mind control experiments. And what he did was he would try to hypnotize women, specifically like his secretary, and give them a post-hypnotic suggestion to become receptive to telepathic suggestion. And according to the story that I've heard, he and his colleagues at one evening were together, and they said, hey, let's try to send the secretary, whom he'd hypnotized, a suggestion that she needs to come over here right now. So they did. And then they thought, you know, what if she gets lost, or I wonder if she's even doing it? And so they went over, they started walking over to the secretary's house, and it turns out she had this sudden compulsion to get up and go to where they were, and she was already walking over. And they met her, and she had no idea why she had this impulse. But she did, at least that's the report. So that would be a little closer to the biblical model of possession, since it involves mind-to-mind contact. It's not fully, though, like entering the person and seizing control of them. So what about like departed human spirits? Could they do this? Well, maybe. Now, I've got to introduce a terminological clarification. We today use the word demon to refer to a fallen angel. That's the way the term demon is used in theology and in church documents today. So demons by definition are non-human spirits, but it hadn't always been that way. The term demon has been used in Jewish and Christian contexts in other ways. For example, I recently did a Mysterious World about the Erling exorcism in the early 20th century. It's publicized, among other things, in a booklet called Begone Satan. And one of the things that's clear from this booklet is even in the early 20th century here in America, Catholics, at least in this connected with this Erling exorcism, were using the term demon to include human spirits, because the energumen, the possessed woman in this case, reported being possessed by Judas Iscariot and by the spirit of her own father and the spirit of her father's lover. So that would be three human spirits that she reported being possessed by. And they called them demons in the booklet. So that's at least a survival of an older usage. But if you go back to Second Temple literature, like the New Testament and the writings of Josephus, it's clear that demons were often considered to be not just fallen angels, but departed human spirits. And there is some evidence in the New Testament, even though it never says that's what's happening directly. If you look at the instances of possession in the New Testament, there is a plausible case, given that we know the term was used also for human spirits, that some of them are human, like in the possession of the Gadarene or Gerasene demoniacs that we read about in Matthew and Mark, because Jesus goes to, he's in this territory, he meets the demoniacs, and where are they? Where have they been hanging out? Among the tombs, in graveyards. Hmm. And so that could suggest that these were departed human spirits, since they're hanging out in human graveyards. So there is at least some evidence that it might be possible for a departed human spirit to take control of a living human. The evidence in the New Testament is suggestive but not conclusive in that regard. There are other flat statements in authors like Josephus that say, yeah, sometimes it's a human spirit possessing a human. And there are even reports in exorcism situations down through church history where the spirit at least claimed to be a departed human spirit. But rule number one of dealing with demons is do not believe anything at all they say, because they are lying liars who are working for the father of lies. So I can honestly say there are reports of this, but whether they should be believed is a whole nother matter.
Mari, that's a whole lot of information. I hope that was helpful, because that was very fascinating. Well, when we come back, we're going to take more questions on the special Weird Questions episode of Catholic Answers Live.
Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool and your homeschool co-op, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The Adoration Sodality of the Poor Clares of Perpetual Adoration at the Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament in Hanceville, Alabama, is a prayer group for laity, priests, and religious brothers and sisters to spiritually join in the nuns' mission of adoring our Lord Jesus Christ in the Holy Eucharist. Members commit themselves to an hour of Eucharistic adoration on a monthly, weekly, or daily basis at a monstrance or tabernacle at the parish of their choice. Learn more about becoming a member at iadorethee.com.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin. So we're not taking your live calls, but hey, if you ever want to ask Jimmy a weird question, send an email, radio@catholic.com, and we'll forward it over to Jimmy, and then you'll get your question. So let's continue. We go over to Jocelyn, and Jocelyn asks, my 9-year-old son loves listening to your show. He's wondering if you could shed any light on what might happen if the souls in purgatory when the end of the world comes. Do they get forcibly zapped through the rest to the rest? I'm sorry, I'm butchering this. Do they get forcibly zapped through the rest of their purification process?
Well, howdy to Jocelyn and howdy to your 9-year-old son. I hope he's doing great. This is a question that I can answer with a substantial degree of confidence because it's one of the, it happens to be a subject that there is a Bible verse that directly bears on it. the passage you want to, you and your son want to look at is 1 Corinthians 15. Verses 51 and 52. And there, Paul is talking about the resurrection of the dead, and he says, behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, meaning we're not all going to die, but we all shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we shall be changed. And we're told elsewhere, like in 1 John, that we're going to be changed to be like Jesus, because we're going to see him as he is. Okay, well, this says that at the end of the world, so the last trumpet, all of us, at least all Christians, we're all going to be changed. And he says that's going to happen in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. The twinkling of an eye is essentially the time it takes you to recognize somebody. And so that's, you know, basically instantaneously. And so St. Paul indicates that this transformation that's going to happen to living people is going to be basically instantaneous. Well, if the transformation happens to living people instantaneously, then it would also happen to any departed spirits that are still being purified. It's like we're all going to be changed all at once at the second coming to be ready to greet Christ and be in his presence and things like that. So yes, if someone is still being purified at the end of the world, when Jesus comes back, they, like the living humans, should be transformed instantly. It's not like the living humans get transformed instantly, and then if you were dead, you're going to have to wait for a longer period. So that would seem to be the basic answer here. The next question, though, is one I don't have as good of an answer for, and that's, well, if at the end of the world people get changed instantly, what about sooner than that? Because there is a because if God can transform people and make them perfectly pure instantly, then, well, he could do that now. And in fact, there is a, it's not an apostolic tradition, but there is a tradition, lowercase tradition, or just an idea in the history of Catholic thought that time does not work the same way in the afterlife as it does in life. Time still exists in some form, but it may not work the way it does here. In the Middle Ages, theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas had a name for the way they thought time works in the afterlife. They called it aveternity. It's different than time, and it's different than eternity. It's kind of midway between the two. It has some characteristics of time as we experience it, but it also has some characteristics of eternity. And aveternity doesn't map neatly onto earthly time. So it could be that from an earthly perspective, people's purification happens instantly. And in a few years ago, when Pope Benedict XVI was Pope, he wrote an encyclical called Spe Salvi, which means saved in hope. And he talked about this, and he said that the duration of purgatory cannot be calculated in earthly time. So from an earthly perspective, it could be instantaneous even today. The question would then be, well, what about praying for people, you know, who are in purgatory? Because I've got to pray for them in time. And if their purification is instant, how does my prayer help them? Well, one of the things that Pope Benedict said was that it doesn't matter, because God, he is totally outside of time. And so he can help someone no matter when they are. So even if their purification is instantaneous, God can still help them. And it doesn't matter that they're already out of purgatory from an earthly perspective, because God could help them when they were in purgatory. Even if it's instant and in our past, God could help them when they were in it, because he's outside of time. He sees all times simultaneously. And so just like if you're praying for someone in the future, if you're praying for someone in the past, God can still help that person. And so as Pope Benedict said, it is never too late to pray for someone in purgatory.
Beautiful. Jocelyn, thank you for your question, and thank your 9-year-old son for that question as well. When we come back, more questions with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Was Jesus? It's the most important question in the world. Was he a great teacher? A religious myth? The Messiah and Lord? In Evidence for Christ, apologist Jimmy Akin builds a powerful step-by-step case from history, scripture, and reason, showing that Jesus is the fulfillment of prophecy and the risen Lord. Get your copy of Jimmy Akin's Evidence for Christ today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Feeling stuck? Feeling like you're not sure what's next? Well, you can be sure of this. God is not finished with you yet. In his new book, Not Finished Yet, Dr. Marcus Peter shares a powerful message of hope, healing, and transformation in Jesus Christ. Read it to discover how to overcome struggles, embrace grace, and step into the life God is calling you to. Get Not Finished Yet today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The world has a lot of questions about Catholicism. It's a big faith, and it deserves a big book of answers. Well, now it has two. Get the Big Book of Catholic Answers, Volume 2, and have 300 clear, reliable Catholic answers right at your fingertips whenever something comes up at work, with friends, or around the dinner table. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers, Volume 2, at shop.catholic.com, or pick one up at your favorite Catholic bookstore.
Welcome back. Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Before we get back to some more questions, because it is Friday, and every Friday a new episode of Mysterious World drops. Jimmy, what came out today?
Today we had an episode on a phenomenon that has been reported throughout human history, but it began to be studied about 140 years ago, and scientifically studied, and they needed a name for it, and the name they came up with was crisis apparitions. Now, an apparition is when something appears. In fact, that's where the word apparition comes from. Something that appears is an apparition. Well, what's a crisis? Well, that's fairly straightforward. A crisis is an emergency, maybe even an emergency where you die. And what they discovered back in the 1880s over in England with the Society for Psychical Research, what they discovered is that a lot of the times when people reported the apparition of a ghost, the person was actually still alive. These looked like apparitions, not of deceased people, but of living people. And they frequently coincided plus or minus 12 hours with the with a crisis in which the person frequently died. And so the definition of a crisis apparition is when an apparition of a person appears within 12 hours of a crisis, either up to 12 hours before the crisis or up to 12 hours after. Frequently it is, but not always, it is a crisis that involves their death. And so there are loads of reports of people saying, you know, my father died and at the moment he died, he appeared to me. Or my son was in this terrible accident and got injured, and at that moment he appeared to me. And actually, you know how medical science today uses, well, I'll tell the story from the other end. There was a gentleman who at the time was doing his, this was, you know, in the late 1800s, and he was in Prussia, which is part of Germany today. And there was a compulsory requirement. You had to do a certain amount of military service. So he was doing his military service, and he was in the artillery, which is the guys who shoot cannons. And the cannons at the time were drawn by horses. Well, there was this runaway horse incident, and this guy was seriously injured by some horses that were dragging a cannon. And then that later that day, he gets a telegram from his father. And his father said, your sister said that she had this sudden awareness of you being hurt. Are you okay? She insisted that we stop what we're doing and pray for you, and that I send you this to find out if you're okay. And it turns out that his sister had had this awareness of his accident at the exact moment it happened. And he became so interested in this that he had been planning on being like an astronomer. But he was a young man at the time because he was still doing his compulsory military service. He decided to go into medicine. He became a psychiatrist, and he became specifically, and you have to have a medical degree for that. And he decided that he wanted to, he said, my sister obviously had this telepathic impression of me. I want to find out how that works. I want to find out a way to measure the thoughts that were used to connect me and my sister in this moment. And so he developed the electroencephalogram that we still use to measure people's brain waves. Now, telepathy would be a little more complex than this, but still, this is a foundational thing that is still used in modern medicine. We still use EEGs to measure people's brain waves, and the reason we have that device is because of a crisis apparition.
Wow.
So today's mystery is all about crisis apparitions.
All right, well, there you have it. Check it out on Jimmy Akin YouTube channel or at mysterious.fm to check that out after the show. So check that out. All right, let's go over to the next question. It is by Rez Carey 8809. They ask, if you have good reason to believe a ghost in purgatory is trying to get your attention, is it morally okay to ask them to reveal their identity? Context. A few years ago, I was home alone with my newborn daughter on All Souls Day, and I heard repeated loud rattling sounds coming from the kitchen. The baby began screaming. I calmly walked out and said, "Whoever is bothering my baby, go away." The rattling stopped, and I have never heard it since. I have had a mass said for the soul, and also for one person I suspect it might have been, but I'm not sure. Is it forbidden to ask for such knowledge, or should I be content to wait?
Okay, so let's take this piece at a time. The first thing Rez Carey says is, if you have good reason to believe a ghost in purgatory is trying to get your attention, is it morally okay to ask them to reveal their identity? Well, if Rez and I were talking face to face, my first question would be, well, why wouldn't it be? You know, why wouldn't, if a person walks up to me and is trying to get my attention, you know, a living person, I'm going to say, well, who are you? And there's nothing wrong with me asking, who are you, of a living person? So why would there be any problem with me asking, who are you, of a deceased person? Now, some people have heard this idea, and this ain't church teaching. But some people have this idea that, oh, you're not allowed to talk to spirits. Well, nonsense, you're not allowed to talk to spirits. The New Testament expects Christians to encounter spirits and talk to them. If you read, for example, 1 John 4, John says, okay, don't believe every spirit. Well, number one, that means you're talking with them if they're telling you stuff, presumably. But he says, but he makes it clear, even clearer, because he says, don't believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they're of God. And then he goes on to discuss how you can do that. Well, you can't test a spirit if you don't talk to it. You know, and so the New Testament expects Christians to be in contact with spirits and to talk to them and to test them and find out if they are, if they're from God or if they're from some other source. Well, I would say, therefore, yeah, there's no problem. Just like you can ask a living person, who are you? You can ask a deceased spirit, who are you? Now, that doesn't mean you should automatically believe them, because as we discussed before the break, demons are lying liars who lie and are working for the father of lies. And as St. Paul says, you know, Satan can disguise himself as an angel of light. So you don't want, they will lie about who they are. So you don't want to just believe what they tell you. I mean, not if you have evidence to the contrary, but you would want to test them. And that's what St. John is saying in 1 John 4. So, yeah, absolutely. You can ask them. And there's some interesting history that a lot of people are not aware of. I find a lot of people who make pronouncements in these areas are really not that deeply educated in the broader Catholic tradition on these points. People who make absolute declarations like, you're never supposed to talk to spirits. Well, that's not what St. Thomas Aquinas would say. In fact, he envisioned, and this is based on a question that he answered in his quadlibetal questions, which were the ancient version of a Catholic Answers Live AMA, mm-hmm. where you could ask anything, the medieval equivalent, where you could ask anything you wanted, and Aquinas, if he's doing the AMA, he'd give you an answer. Well, one of the questions that was put to him was, can you ask a dying person to reveal their fate after death? You know, did you make it to heaven, or are you in purgatory, or did you go to hell? And he said, yeah, you can. Not in terms of like you're testing God to see if there's really an afterlife. You shouldn't do that. But he said it's natural to seek knowledge, and there's nothing wrong with having this knowledge. So yeah, you could do that. You could talk to a dying person and say, if you're able, after you've passed on, you know, I'd love it if you could come back and let me know, did you make it, or do you need prayers, or things like that. And so Aquinas envisioned that person then dying and having communication with you. In fact, he had communication with his own sister after she died. She appeared to him on more than one occasion. The first time she appeared, she said, hey, bro, because he was her bro. She said, hey, bro, I'm being purified right now, and I could really use some prayers and masses. So he arranged for that to happen. And we have like his younger contemporary, Bishop Bernard of Guy, who was his biographer that recorded this. So this is not something that was recorded centuries later. This is like recorded shortly after he died, that his sister had appeared to him and she had asked for prayers and masses. He arranged for those to happen. And then his sister comes back and says, "Dude, it worked. Thank you so much." And she, he says, but then he asks questions. He doesn't ignore her or refuse to talk to her. Instead, he asks questions and he says, "What about my two brothers who have died, Reginald and Landulf? How are they doing?" And his sister says, "Well, Reginald is already in heaven, but Landulf is still being purified." And I don't know whether he, I don't recall, did he himself ask about this or not? But what she then told him is, "You're going to be joining us soon, but you're going to get a greater reward than we are because of your labors for the church." But notice he's talking with his sister. So, yeah, you could ask if you suspect a soul in purgatory is trying to get your attention, you can pay attention. You can ask them who they are. You could test them. You don't necessarily have to. You could just say, if you get a message like, "Yeah, mine, I just need prayers," even if you don't know who they are. I mean, if they tell you, great. If they don't, but if they're trying to get prayers or masses, well, then pray for them. Have mass said for them. Totally fine, good thing to do. And there are many other examples. Now, I just named one from Thomas Aquinas, but there are many examples throughout Christian history where Christians do not have any problem talking to purgatorial spirits or spirits that are of unknown origin. Like, to give an unknown origin one, around the year 414, St. Martin of Tours was a bishop in France. And there was, this incident is recorded in Pope Gregory the Great's dialogues. But he records that St. Martin of Tours was concerned because there was this local shrine that was supposed to be a shrine to a martyr. But it wasn't clear that it was really a shrine to a martyr. And Martin of Tours was not, he wanted validation. He didn't want a shrine to a martyr if it's not a martyr. You know, he wanted to make sure that people are only venerating a martyr if it's a real martyr. So he got some of his priests and they went to the site. And they prayed that this whatever spirit it was would appear to them, you know, be an apparition, and the spirit appears. And Martin says, "Well, like, who are you?" And he says, "Actually, I'm not a martyr. I was a criminal, and I died and was buried here, and people thought I was a martyr because there was a lot of confusion. It was shortly after the Age of Martyrs, and they built this shrine even though I'm not a martyr." And so Martin said, "Thank you very much," and they moved the shrine to an actual sacred place. And we'll notice that he didn't know who this spirit was, and he had no problem talking with him. And so talking to unknown spirits and checking them out and talking to spirits in purgatory, this is a totally normal thing in Catholic history.
Well, there you have it, Rez Carey. Thank you for your question. Let's go over to our final break for the hour. When we come back, we'll take more weird questions with Jimmy again.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because it is the food of the saints that we receive. And for the saints, they understood rightly that the time after Holy Communion, that those moments are the most precious moments of our lives.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Weird questions, and we'll jump back. We'll jump right back into it because the hour's flying by too quickly. So I want to try to get more questions here. Severe Famine asks, "Are there fallen guardian angels? If so, do we get a replacement if our intended guardian angel fell?"
Well, this is an interesting question in that there is not a single answer that the church mandates on it. So what I'll do is I'll tell you the common view, then I'll tell you what the alternatives to the common view are, and then I'll tell you what conclusion I think we can draw. The common view is that any angels who fell did so before the creation of men. That is, God made the angels first, and that's pretty well solid in Catholic thought. It's not, but the idea of when they fell is not as well defined. What the Catechism says is they fell through their own fault, but it didn't tell us when. Or whether it was all at once. Now, a common opinion that in part was supported by St. Thomas Aquinas is that they had to make a choice in the first moment of their existence, and that permanently set their course. If they chose in the first moment of their existence to support God or oppose God, that then becomes fixed. But the key thing for this question is, did it happen, if they were created before man, did it happen in the first moment of their existence? Because if it did, well, then any angels who fell before there were any humans to guard. So your guardian angel would be, assuming you have only one, and that it's the same all the time, and I don't think either of those are guaranteed because Scripture doesn't say either of those. You might have more than one guardian angel, or there might be, you might have different guardians at different times. But if any angel that fell would have fallen before you were around, and therefore would never have been assigned to you as a guardian. So if the common view is correct, your guardian angel is unfallen and will permanently be unfallen. So that's the common view. Are there any alternatives? Well, there are, because the church has not mandated that they all fell at the same time in the first moment of their existence. That's a theological proposal, but it's not church teaching. Do we see any evidence for them falling in stages? Well, in fact, we do. The devil first shows up in the form of the snake in Genesis 3. So he's already fallen. We don't know when that happened. There's some interesting extra biblical literature, like the Life of Adam and Eve, that discusses that, but it's not part of the Bible. But we know the devil has fallen by Genesis 3. But then we get up to Genesis 6, and it refers to the sons of God marrying the daughters of men and giving birth to the Nephilim. Okay, so the phrase sons of God in the Old Testament normally refers to high-ranking angels. And Nephilim is the Aramaic word for giants. So, and I've got several episodes, both of Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin podcast, that deal with the Nephilim. So you can look those up for more information. But what it looks like is happening in Genesis 6, and this is confirmed in other Jewish literature, like the Book of Enoch, which is actually quoted in the New Testament, is that there were at least 200 angels that fell in Genesis 6. They abandoned their heavenly dwelling. That's something the Book of Jude refers to, and were tempted by strange flesh, meaning human flesh in this case. So that would be two falls of angelic spirits, and St. Paul may hold out the possibility of more, because in 1 Corinthians, he says something very strange, and I won't go through it in super detail because we're coming up on the end of the episode of this hour, but he says that women ought to wear head coverings in church because of the angels, and it's a very unusual passage. But the best explanation for it is that, and this I'm going to omit some details here, but the best explanation that scholars have been able to come up with is it looks like in the first century, based on the medical science of the day, they viewed women's hair as a sexual characteristic, the long hair that would actually help them have babies, not just by attracting a man, but the hair itself would help them have babies. So it was a sexual characteristic, and to be flaunting your sexual characteristic in church, bad idea. You want to keep that covered for modesty's sake. And so when Paul says you want to do this, you want to keep it covered because of the angels, well, we know that our worship blends into the heavenly worship. So, I mean, you know, we invoke the angels at Mass, you know, and so if they're looking down on our earthly worship and worshiping God with us, and we know they've fallen before because of human women, you don't necessarily want them looking down and seeing women flaunting their sexual characteristics. So the logic that St. Paul seems to be using is we don't want to tempt any of the angels. And that would suggest that that they could still fall. Well, if this staged fall view is correct, then, and I'm not saying it is, but if it's correct, then hypothetically your guardian angel could fall unless God only picked guardians from those angels who were already confirmed in goodness. If he allowed angels that were still undergoing their probationary period to be guardians, then hypothetically your guardian could fall. But that leads us to the conclusion that I think can be reasonably drawn, which is, even if that happened, God's not going to let us go unguarded. Even if it were possible for your guardian angel to fall, if the common view is incorrect, and even if your angel did fall, God's not going to leave you unguarded. He gives people guardian angels for a reason, and it's just like, you know, if you've got a jeweler's store and you've hired guards to guard it and one of them turns into a criminal, well, you fire him and hire a new guard. And God, we're as precious to God as diamonds in a jewelry store. So, I mean, he died for us. He shed his blood for us. So he's not going to let us go unguarded. So you don't have to worry about, is your guardian angel going to fall? Even if he could, even if he did, you're still going to be protected. God will make sure you have a guardian who's going to keep you safe.
There you have it, severe famine. Hopefully that was helpful. Fascinating.
And good luck with that severe famine problem, too.
Well, hopefully all this knowledge will help cure some of that hunger he has, at least for the knowledge sake, not the physical sake, I guess. All right. Well, Jimmy, since we're coming close to the end, I wanted to ask you, I already asked you about A Mysterious World, but every Monday you have the Jimmy Akin podcast. So what did we just have this past Monday?
So the most recent, since yesterday was Ascension Thursday, I decided to prepare for that by releasing an episode on Monday about Jesus's ascension. You know, what happened there? Did he fly into outer space? You know, would he be traveling at the speed of light? He'd still be in the Milky Way galaxy. and what's really going on in this passage. So it's much more interesting than some of the mocking you sometimes hear from skeptics, and the ascension, and why would he do this? There's actually some very good reasons why he didn't just like disappear in a burst of light. The ascension teaches us lessons. Coming up this Monday, we're going to be heading towards Pentecost. So this Monday, I'm going to have an episode on Pentecost and what the actual tongues were, because this is a big dispute in some circles. But if we take a careful look at the evidence in the book of Acts and in 1 Corinthians, we can tell what kind of tongues Luke is talking about here. And so that's coming up this Monday. So two episodes tied to our current liturgical season with information about the Ascension and Pentecost.
All right. And if you can find that on any place you listen to your podcast, and also on the Jimmy Akin YouTube channel, which is kind of great because you can, it's a one-stop shop for all of your podcasts of Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin podcast. So check that out, Jimmy Akin at YouTube. Just type that into the search bar. Well, we still have a whole other hour of weird questions. So hang in there, go take a break, go grab some water, go grab some coffee, and come and hang out with us in just a few minutes. We'll be right back with Catholic Answers Live.